From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Claire Strempel with a local and statewide news update. The federal government has announced plans to take over management of silver salmon in the federal waters of the lower Kuskokwim River for the first time ever. That's if the silver run stays low, KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
According to both federal and state biologists, silver runs are low and late, and they want to implement closures to help protect the runs.
We wouldn't be taking action if we didn't feel like it was an emergency. This is about as close to an emergency as you could get in fisheries. We're trying to preserve what little is left of coho salmon, and it just really is a little amount.
Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge manager Boyd Blehovde announced his intentions in Wednesday's Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group meeting. He said he'll draft the plans in close consultation with the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission and biologists. He also said despite the restrictions, he plans to hang on to at least a few subsistence openings for silver fishing. If the new federal emergency actions come into play, it will mark one of the first times coho salmon fishing has been this heavily restricted on the Kuskokwim. Managers are calling for restrictions because of the low numbers of silvers swimming up the river. According to data from the Bethel test fishery, the silver run is the second lowest in the past decade. The state says the run is not projected to make escapement goals. The federal announcement of emergency management actions comes one day after the state released its own management recommendations, which the working group failed to pass. In the rejected plan, the managers from the state government had recommended closing the entire Kuskokwim and all of its tributaries to subsistence fishing for silver salmon starting next week through the end of September. Subsistence users up and down the river balked at the state's plan to close the entire river for more than a month, calling it overly restrictive. Tribal Chief Mike Williams Sr. of Akiak says he recognizes the need to protect the run, but for him, there's a more important aspect.
My biggest fear is that drastic management action without any food to eat for 2 months is not good for the families and our health.
Other users with traditional knowledge like Fritz Charles said the river is only feeling its first pulse of fish right now, and they expect another pulse to come through soon. He also said that explains the small body size of the first run of silvers.
When there's fish like this, they're extra small this year. That means they're going to be plentiful this year.
The working group unanimously voted to support the federal management of coho in the federal waters of the lower Kuskokwim River. It also voted to recommend the state mirror lower river management restrictions in the state-controlled sections of the river. State biologist Nick Smith said he would have to see what the federal actions would be before he would agree to mirror them. He also defended his call for stricter regulations on the entire river.
Right now, we're not projected to meet escapement, so the harvest needs to be curtailed until a time that we make escapement.
Smith has purview over management decisions in the Middle and Upper River, Sections 4 and 5, but is prevented by the courts from announcing conflicting management decisions in Sections 1 through 3 of the Lower River. That's because of a restraining order issued against the state of Alaska. The order is part of an ongoing lawsuit that the federal government has filed against the state for management control of the river. The federal government agreed with the state's assessment of the low run, but still said it wanted to protect at least some subsistence fishing. Refuge manager Boyd Blehovde said he would not announce the emergency special action details prior to Saturday, saying he would need some time to draft a plan in consultation with federal and tribal biologists and the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
When Mike Dunleavy ran for governor 4 years ago, he was the conservative candidate, running far to the right of the incumbent. Now, as he vies for re-election, Dunleavy's got two well-funded candidates running to the right of him, Wasilla Representative Christopher Kirka and Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports on how the conservatives are hoping to set themselves apart.
The primary election on Tuesday, August 16th, is going to pare the list of 10 gubernatorial candidates to 4, and it's unlikely that Representative Kirka and Mayor Pierce can both survive. The challengers are trying to distinguish themselves from each other and from Governor Dunleavy, primarily on performance and commitment. At a recent campaign event in Willow, Pierce said Dunleavy's record shows a, quote, lack of urgency to get anything done.
I look at what what the current administration's accomplished, and I think the list is short.
Under Dunleavy, Pierce says, the state budget has been out of kilter. He says after starting his mayoral term with a deficit, he put the Kenai Peninsula borough on a solid fiscal path. Pierce sees himself as more conservative than Dunleavy, but not as right-wing as Kirka.
You know, I'm not an extreme far-right Republican. I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I've lived by those principles in my life.
Pierce chose Edie Grunwald as his running mate. She's from the Mat-Su and rose to prominence as the mother of murder victim David Grunwald. They reported raising nearly $200,000. Kirka is a past board member and director of Alaska Right to Life, a nonprofit that advocates against abortion rights. He was first elected to the legislature 2 years ago. His running mate, Paul Huper of Homer, was part of a throng of Trump supporters who were at the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th attack, but says he did not go inside. The FBI later searched Huper's home in what turned out to be a case of mistaken identity. Kirka and Huper have raised close to $170,000. Kirka said Dunleavy hasn't lived up to promises he made ahead of his first term, such as delivering a so-called statutory permanent fund dividend and significantly reducing the state budget.
So when I got elected to the state house, I was expecting to go down to Juneau and back him up. There was nobody to back up. He had abandoned the field. He was no longer in the fight.
Dunleavy has raised far more than Kirka and Pierce, $1.7 million. He also has the endorsement of the Alaska Republican Party. In 4 years as governor, Dunleavy has backed off on some of the more aggressive policies he started office with. In 2018, he proposed a budget that would have cut state ferry system funding by more than two-thirds and made sharp spending reductions to the university system, public schools, and Alaska Pioneer Homes. The budget passed this year is the sixth largest in state history, in part because oil revenue is up. It includes a $3,200 PFD. That's lower than what would have been set by state statute, but the highest on record. And while Dunleavy campaigned on a statutory PFD plus back pay, the thousands of dollars he felt Alaskans were owed since the previous administration vetoed part of the dividend, he is now pushing for a 50-50 plan that would split spending between Alaskans and the state government. Dunleavy disagrees with his opponent's characterizations.
I think I've kept my promises really well. Public safety, for example, we brought down the crime rate, and that's according to FBI statistics. With the exception of education and public safety, our agency budgets are lower than they were when I first got in. We navigated a pandemic without locking people in their houses or mandating masks or vaccines.
And Dunleavy says he's relying on his record.
I am sure there are people in the state that think I am very conservative. I'm sure there's probably a handful that don't think I'm conservative enough. But these are interesting questions. These are questions that rarely do we discuss because we're focused on governing for all of Alaska, and we're pretty confident and certain in as much as our grounding and our values and principles.
Dunleavy argues Kirka's year and a half as a legislator and Pierce's 5 years as a borough mayor don't compare to his experience as governor. He says it's like comparing apples and oranges. With help from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
The U.S. Department of the Interior will be required to hold an oil and gas lease sale in Cook Inlet before the end of the year. That's according to a section of the new Inflation Reduction Act passed by the U.S. House last Friday. The 730-page act, awaiting President Joe Biden's signature, tackles tax and health reform and invests billions in renewable energy. But it also requires the feds to hold several lease sales this year, including a long-contested sale in Cook Inlet. Even when the feds have scheduled Cook Inlet lease sales in the past, those plans always come with the qualifier that they could be canceled due to lack of industry interest. And they have been, repeatedly. But the new act says the lease sale must go forward before December 31st of this year. That means the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management, which oversees the offshore program, can't change or cancel the sale regardless of whether they think they'll get bids, says Liz Meering, advocacy director for the Cook Inlet Keeper.
However, just because BOEM holds a sale doesn't necessarily mean that anybody will show up to bid.
The lease sale requirement was added to the act by Senator Lisa Murkowski and West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin, said Murkowski spokesperson Hannah Ray. Ray says the goal is to remedy the decision earlier this year to cancel the sale and make sure that won't happen again. Before it can put out a request for bids, BOEM has to release a final environmental impact statement as well as a final plan and record of decision.